Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and sometimes a good plan can yield bad results.
It's not clear to me that that's good for the markets.
That's Pat Byery with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Pat says some good intentions could cause problems for investors. Once more.
It's not clear to me that that's good for the markets.
So what's got Pat worried? Is it A, a possible rate cut by the Fed? Some say it could lead to another market bubble. Or is Pat worried about B, a rule forcing brokerages to separate their investing and research divisions? It's led some firms to cut back on that research. Or is the problem C, Apple slashing prices on iPhones this week, just 2 months after their release? Early adopters whined and investors took a bite out of Apple stock. Give up? The answer's next on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
You gotta know when to hold them and know when to fold them, and that goes for stocks as well as cards. But it's hard to know what to do when you can't get all the information you need. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Just for fun, go to Google and type in the letters MSFT. What you'll get back is pages and pages and pages of information about Microsoft stock. Financial reports, news about the company, opinions about whether you should buy, sell, or hold. And although Microsoft might be the extreme, it's an apt example of how bewildering it can be to get reliable, solid information. Many investors rely on research from the major brokerages, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, etc. But a lot of those banks are actually making their research less available to the public. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
On a December evening about 5 years ago, Elliot Spitzer appeared on the Charlie Rose Show on PBS. He was New York's attorney general at the time, and he was investigating conflicts of interest between research analysts and investment bankers at the big Wall Street brokerage firms.
The analysts tended to be overly optimistic and push the stocks that the investment bankers were underwriting, whether or not their honest belief was that the stock was a good investment.
Do you believe?
A few days later, Spitzer announced a historic settlement. The major brokerage houses would pay $1.4 billion in fines, and they agreed to sever the ties between their investment banking and research divisions. Pat Byery teaches economics at the University of Minnesota. He says the changes were meant to protect individual investors by providing them with unbiased advice.
But we might have done some things that hurt individual investors at the same time.
For one thing, Byery says the settlement has discouraged investment banks from devoting as many resources to stock research. They can no longer pay for it with investment banking revenue, so many have slashed their research budgets and cut staff. Byery says the number of analysts covering companies on the NASDAQ 100 index has dropped by a third.
Analysts come out with their different earnings forecasts, recommendations about stocks, and when that was out in the public sphere, that was sort of how we had an argument about these companies and their prospects. And to the extent that we shut down that discourse, it's not clear to me that that's good for the markets or good for the economy more broadly.
Another factor has contributed to the research decline. About 7 years ago, a rule took effect that requires corporations to disclose financial information to all investors at the same time. That's made it harder for analysts to generate unique investment ideas, so banks are guarding their research more closely. Merrill Lynch recently announced it would no longer make its research available to non-clients. It also restricted media access to its reports. Michael Ross follows the industry for research firm Tab Group. He says the best investment tips go to those who can pay the most. And these days, hedge funds tend to top the list.
What it comes down to is
when a trade idea comes across to the trading desk, who's going to get that first call? And I think are some of the names that you'd expect to be at the top of the list and who probably were at the top of the list 5 years ago, are they a little further down the list? In some cases, that's probably true.
Institutions that represent smaller investors, like pension and mutual funds, are finding themselves lower on the totem pole. Horacio Valeris manages about $15 billion in assets on behalf of pensions and endowments at Nicholas Applegate Capital Management. He says his clients want to pay less for his services, so he can no longer afford the big banks' prices for top-shelf research.
One major firm actually told me that we needed to increase the commissions we paid them from, you know, about 3 cents a share to 8 cents a share for it to make sense. And, you know, we can't do that.
Valeris says regional brokerages and independent research firms have stepped in to fill the void. And the resourceful small investor like retired courier Martha Perkins can still find plenty of good tips out there.
I haven't gotten fearfully rich and I haven't gone broke. So I guess that's about the best one can ask.
Perkins gets her information from newsletters like the Hulbert Financial Digest, but it too has a price, $59 a year, and Perkins says she spends a few full days a month reading up on investments. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
More glum news on the housing front this week. The Mortgage Bankers Association says the number of homes going into foreclosure hit yet another record in the second quarter. That does not bode well for the future. Politicians and the finance industry are trying to figure out solutions. President Bush recently announced that he'd push for at least a temporary change in tax policy to help homeowners who either short sell or foreclose on their homes. To find out what that's all about, we've turned to Kathy Kristoff. She writes about personal finance in the Los Angeles Times. And Kathy, what is the current tax rule?
The IRS says that this is debt forgiveness income. So if you have a house that's worth $500,000 mm-hmm. or you have a loan for $500,000 and you sell the house for $450,000 and the bank agrees to take that as, you know, payment in full, at the end of the year, you get a little 1099 form saying that you had $50,000 in income. And so you get a tax bill. It can be really horrible because this is a big tax debt, and tax debts are not dischargeable in bankruptcy.
So what is the president proposing?
The president is proposing to at least temporarily halt forgiveness of indebtedness income. Just wipe out that section of the tax code so that we get through this kind of foreclosure crisis for now. But he needs Congress to go along, and tax legislation is almost never quick. But there's also a concern about whether Congress is going to go along. You and I, who didn't get into trouble with our home mortgage debt, are essentially paying the bill.
Right.
If, you know, you give them a tax break for this.
And there's a good chunk of the foreclosure and short sale population that was flippers and people who knew what they were getting into. And so a lot of people see that as, you know, basically a break for them.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't believe the amount of frustration and anger that you hear from, you know, people like you and I who say, well, why am I paying for this guy who was gambling mm-hmm. on his house? Trouble is that there also were all sorts of people in this crisis who were misled.
Right.
They didn't, you know, understand their loan papers. They were completely lied to. And it's very difficult to separate out those two groups, and certainly not in a statistical way. Mm-hmm. So I think Congress may have some real challenge passing that law.
Is there anything that homeowners who really just were simply caught in this can appeal or somehow get out of this tax bill?
Well, if you are insolvent, debt forgiveness income is not assessed. And it's much better, I mean, you know, like to try and do this upfront, because like I said, once the tax bill is assessed, then you owe it and getting out of it is more or less impossible. You need probably a tax accountant to walk through the numbers and establish it, fill out the paperwork with the IRS and claim that, and that would eliminate that tax debt.
And is that something that you should do even before you go to the bank and say, I have to leave the house, I can't afford it?
You know, you should definitely talk to some financial person, either go to a consumer credit counseling service office, hit up your smartest friend, walk through all your options before you lose your home, mm-hmm. of course. It's not a bad idea if you know you're going to have this sort of a hit to talk to a tax accountant in advance.
Kathy Kristoff is a personal finance columnist for the LA Times. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Say, even though summer doesn't officially end for a couple of weeks, this is our last episode of Summer School. 10 lessons in 10 weeks. So before graduation, perhaps a little review. Maybe you remember bond, savings bond. For the difference between a bond's price and its yield, we turned to Bankrate.com secret agent analyst Greg McBride.
The price of a bond is the price at which the bond is currently trading. And the yield reflects the return that investors will earn if they buy that bond and hold it until it matures. Now, what happens is that prices fluctuate on an almost daily basis in markets. And as the prices fluctuate, so too do the yields.
And LNF, let's not forget, GDP, Gross Domestic Product. Diane Swonk, the chief economist with Mesro Financial, cooked up a nifty explanation for us.
Almost all other economic indicators somehow influence GDP. It's kind of like all the ingredients of GDP are all the economic indicators that we can possibly collect on the economy. And then the GDP factor is the, you know, stew that comes out when you're all done putting all those ingredients together.
And our most important lesson this summer: finance doesn't have to be so boring and stale that you hurl yourself off a cliff holding a sign that says, uh-oh. Here's economist Chris Lowe with his take on the P.E. ratio.
Imagine Wile E. Coyote's favorite company, Acme Corporation, just released earnings at $5 a share. And the share price is $20 right now. So the P.E. would be the price divided by earnings, which is 4. So Wile E. Coyote's doing pretty well, assuming he's buying the shares. Of course, if he's buying the products, we all know how that turns out.
Special thanks to our instructors, Greg McBride, Diane Swonk, and Chris Lowe. And, you know, even though summer school is over for this year, that doesn't mean there's nothing left to learn. Send us your suggestions for what to cover next year. But till then, let me present the 2007 graduating class of the Marketplace Money Summer School. All right, enough. So what's a penny stock worth? Less than the coin it's based on, apparently. Chris offers his 2 cents in the mailbag, and we offer a glimpse into the thrill-a-minute world of a professional athlete.
I like to go back and read, take a nap sometimes.
A day in the work life of a soccer goalie. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. There are good investments and not so good investments. LA's pro soccer team, the Galaxy, may be wondering which one it made when it brought superstar footballer David Beckham over from England for a pretty pence. He got injured 2 weeks ago, again. Of course, with all the attention on Becks, some may have forgotten there are 10 other players on the field. So on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we turn a much-deserved spotlight on the Galaxy's goalie.
And Olsen now for United. Here they come on the counterattack the other way. Emilio, top of the Galaxy penalty area. Watch out for the left foot on goal, and it's saved by Cannon. The rebound loose, and he smothers it.
My name is Joe Cannon. I'm the goalkeeper for the Los Angeles Galaxy.
Sims from 30 fires, and a save by Joe Cannon. Looked like he got a hand on it, but it's a goal kick, says our referee, regardless.
When I was 14, you know, I had an old club soccer coach that let me know I had some potential in the sport, and if I work hard enough, I can get a college scholarship. I made that my goal, to get myself through college by playing goalkeeper, and I think it shows me just how much when people, you know, say a nice word or say something about you. I mean, if he would have never told my parents that or never said anything, I don't even know if I'd be here today. To be honest, everyone is always like, oh, what a great job. It must be so exciting to be a professional soccer player. And it is. It has its perks. But at the same time, there's people in their league that, you know, will go out and sometimes go to the beach or do their own hobbies, surf, golf. You know, I, to be honest, don't have too much energy after practice. I think I give, and a lot of guys give a lot during training. I like to go back and read, take a nap sometimes. The goalkeeper practice is obviously a lot different than all the other field players. You know, what we'll basically do is warm up our hands, get the ball shot right at us, volleys, and then diving to the ground. That's considered a warm-up. Our bodies are getting used to hitting the ground, and then basically the whole preparation is to warm yourself up and to be ready for the game during practice, because a lot of times we'll come in and the other players will have a shooting practice when they're shooting at you, and they don't care if you haven't warmed up, so, you know, they're going to blast as hard as they can, you know. In practices is where you earn your job. In the games is how you keep your job. I'm actually very fortunate. I'm one of the higher paid guys. It's, you know, over 200 grand. You compare it to other athletes and you're like, well, it's not that much. But when you compare it to athletes in our sport, you know that you're making a lot of money. It's comparatively to some players in the team. So I just feel pretty fortunate. I mean, I can easily live within my means. Just got to keep playing well, and no one will say anything about the money. With David Beckham on the team, the media has been ridiculous. So it's been interesting. It's a challenge to try to kind of find a way to get to know somebody off the field when they have so many commitments. And he's a person that is to himself a lot. And so for a guy like myself, I think it's just a matter of making him feel comfortable, letting him settle in. And I'm sure after all this media goes away, he'll have more time just to, you kind of get to know him. There's always points in a game where your team's kind of struggling or not getting the best of the other team, and coming up with a big save at an appropriate time. For me, that's kind of why I play. You know, I really like to work hard and to try to make those moments happen.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Francesca Segret.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
A growing pain brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, LIBOR. LIBOR stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. It's the rate which international banks charge each other for loans. It's also used for calculating adjustable rate mortgages. And that's where the pain comes in. Why? Because of the credit and subprime crisis, the LIBOR is rising fast. This week, it swelled to the highest level in 6 years. That means if you've got a $400,000 adjustable rate mortgage, you could end up paying $47,000 more over the life of the loan. Ouch! That hurts!
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life.
Hello, everyone. It's that time where we get to all your personal finance questions. It's what we call our mailbag, and along with me is our own Chris Farrell. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. Did you have a good long weekend?
No, actually, I worked on Monday, but that's okay. You know, we got to keep the wheels of commerce going.
Okay.
The news never stops. All right. Well, before we get to everyone's questions, let's ask them to take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or if you like, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right. Let's hit the phones. Robert is with us from Miami, Florida. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do there in Florida?
I'm a physician in Florida, a general practitioner. And I also run something called MiniMed for people who don't have insurance, where if they have a minor medical problem, I'll see them for just $30 for things like coughs and colds.
That's interesting. Is that just something that you decided to do on your own in your private practice?
Yeah, because I believe we need socialized medicine in this country. I think we have what I call wealth care instead of health care in the U.S., and I think that's wrong.
Well, bravo for you for going ahead and taking care of this underserved population. How are you doing that, given that you've, you know, you're certainly out of medical school at this point, but my guess is you're still paying your student loans?
Well, I got about $200,000 in student loans, and I enrolled in something called the Direct Loans Income Contingent Repayment Plan. The government gives me 25 years to pay off these loans, and the most they require me to pay back is 20% of my AGI each year. If I don't pay it off over the 25 years, they write the loan off. I don't have to pay it back at that point. But the balance that is still due, they report to the IRS as income for that year.
So what's your plan at this point?
Well, what I'm doing to counterbalance this, I'm putting the maximum I can into a Roth IRA each year. If it goes to tax debt like I plan, the IRS should say you owe us approximately $70,000, which will be the tax value on that debt. And at that point, hopefully, I can just draw $70,000 tax-free out of the Roth and say, here, we're done.
Well, I have a feeling, just knowing what Chris has said in the past, that first of all, he's not going to be very happy that you're already planning on withdrawing some retirement money for any other purpose. Right, Chris?
Can I just give a couple of brief definitions just for people who might not be aware about the income contingent option that's out there? Your standard repayment plan on your student loans is 10 years. And as you just mentioned, with the income contingent repayment plan, you take 25 years to pay it off. The theory there is you're not making much money, no more than 20% of your AGI or adjusted gross income, and it helps you as you go along.
And Chris, is that something that's available to all students, or is this just a medical school thing?
Yes, it's open to any student. And, you know, it's driven by the field that you choose. For example, if you're going to go into social work, you're not going to be pocketing Wall Street bonuses. And the income contingent loan is ideally suited for someone going into that field or similar fields that are low-income fields.
Well, so what about this idea that he would use his Roth IRA to pay this tax bill?
Well, I think you'll pay the tax bill from some source of income. This can be one of those sources of income. The question that I would have is running some numbers where you would take some of that money that you're putting into the Roth and you'd accelerate your payments into your student loan debt. And financially, just in terms of dollars and cents, which one do you come up ahead on?
Two things. One, I did run the numbers, and I get better interest in the Roth than giving the money to the government. And I do have a SEP also. So it's not my only retirement vehicle.
Okay. Well, that's good. You know, my basic reaction is you're going into this with your eyes open. It's a perfectly viable plan. I don't know if it's one that I would choose, but I think it's a perfectly viable plan.
All right. Does that help you out, Robert?
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Best of luck. All right, let's hit some emails. And Dan writes in from Albany, New York. And Chris, he recently went to his bank to close out a savings account that was earning less than 1%. And I think that's pretty common these days. Unless you bank online, your savings account isn't going to get you much.
Not at all.
So the bank official, though, tried to convince him that it would be good for his credit history to keep the account open. He'd had it for about 15 plus years. So his question is, do these old accounts really benefit your credit record? So should he be keeping this account open?
Well, I think the bank should give the credit officer a bonus. It's a nice little sales technique. If you're young, if you're a young person or you're just starting out, you know, one of the things you do want to do to create a credit history, open up a checking account, open up a savings account. But no, when you're looking at your credit score, your credit history, it's all about credit.
Yeah, and that's really the question about whether you've made payments on time.
Exactly. I mean, that's what matters.
All right. Well, there you go. If you got a question that you don't trust asking any old person or much less a bank employee, let us help. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right. Let's go to the phones again. Gail is with us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome, Gail.
Hi. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do there in Cincinnati?
Well, I started an independent consulting business in business communications. So after 30-plus years working for corporations, 70, 80-hour weeks, I decided I needed to make time for some other stuff, like some volunteer work.
Good for you. And so what have you found that's a little more fulfilling for you?
Definitely more fulfilling, not for the purse, but...
Isn't that always the way it is?
Yeah. And I also have a small animal rescue operation called Silver Bells Rescue, and we're currently in the midst of a huge project called the Foreclosure Cat Project, where we found and rescued more than 60 cats and kittens who were abandoned in a home after it was foreclosed upon.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you've certainly called the right call-in show, because I'm a huge believer in animal rescue and welfare. I work with the Humane Society. So congratulations on your efforts.
Thank you.
Well, is the question that you have for us related to this or something else?
It started out, the question that they initially had originated with the fact that I was talking with my credit card company, and they offered, as they are wont to do, a loan that they suggested I might use to help pay down my mortgage. I have an adjustable rate mortgage, and I have 2 more years on it. It's a 5-1. I have 2 more years at a very low rate, 4.875%.
Wow, you must have financed that back 4 or 5 years ago. Huh?
I did, and I put a lot of money down when I moved to Ohio. I decided to simplify my life. So I've got 2 more years at that rate, and then the lifetime cap is 5%, and it can go up 2 points per year maximum.
So what has the credit card company offered you?
They were offering to send me a check for up to my credit card limit, which would have been about $25,000, to use toward the mortgage.
And what do you have left on your mortgage?
About $119,000.
Okay. And what kind of rate was the credit card company offering you?
It was 3% for the lifetime of that particular loan.
All right. Well, Chris, so the question here is whether Gail should take this $24,000 at 3% and put it on her credit card rather than paying it through her mortgage, which is at 4.5%.
The simple answer is no. And the reason is you have a very good mortgage. You're in a good financial situation. You have 2 years before your mortgage adjusts. You could always refinance if you want to. You could always fix the mortgage if that's what you decide you want to do. And the way these loans are done from the credit card company, there's always a twist and a turn. And by the way, the average credit card agreement, the fine print, is 30 pages. Now, in that 30 pages, this loan could go bad on you very easily. You're late on a payment. All of a sudden, the rate adjusts. So I think when people have a good mortgage, which you do, you have 2 years, plenty of time, you have a solid financial situation, I wouldn't take the money at all. You might want to leave it aside and say, well, you know, at some point, maybe I might, you know, want to borrow $1,000 off of this at 3%, and that's fine, no big deal. But in terms of taking a good mortgage and turning it into credit card debt, absolutely not.
They did tell me that there was one grace episode per year if I were late. I'm really never late. I mean, I should never say never, I know, but I'm very good about paying on time.
But even at that, Chris, really, isn't it here that any time you put anything on a credit card these days, the risk that you're taking if something goes wrong is so huge?
It's just too big. And you know, there's a lot of I know that there's a lot of issues right now with mortgages, but, you know, basically what we're seeing, there's also a lot of protections surrounding mortgages. It sounds like you understand your mortgage, where a lot of the problems arise are people not understanding their mortgage. You have a very good rate. It's going to adjust. It doesn't sound like it's a crazy adjustment that's going to happen, and you know what the adjustment's going to be. So you have a good loan, and I wouldn't modify it. I wouldn't change it unless you're going to change the nature of that mortgage loan itself into perhaps a fixed rate loan, or you just want to pay it off, or whatever you want to do. But there's no reason to turn this into a credit card debt.
I'm glad to hear you reinforce what I was kind of concluding. That gives me some additional insights as well.
Okay. Well, sounds like we've answered your question then.
Yes.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Well, best of luck to you with your efforts in saving the cats and kittens.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Tess and Chris.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call. Well, if you need a financial rescue, let us provide the safety net. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Chris, you ready for one more reach into the email bag?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, Ian writes in from Imperial, California. And last year, he bought almost 3,000 shares of a company for 29 cents a share. Recently, it took a little bit of a dip, as many stocks have.
Now, can we talk about buying penny stocks?
Yes.
Why? Why?
And it went down to 1 cent per share, literally a penny stock. So what can Ian do with what are really these worthless shares at this point? Does he have any tax options to get something out of it?
He does. But Ian, first of all, I just have to say this, and I'm sorry to interrupt Tess, but, you know, there are a lot of good companies in America, publicly traded companies. Why buy penny stocks? I know it's fun because you can buy, what, 2,000 shares, 3,000 shares at 29 cents a share? I don't know. But anyway, it's not a market for people to play in, and people get taken to the cleaners all the time, and there's just lots of scams going on in that business. All right, that said, okay, I'm off my soapbox.
So what can he do? He's already invested.
Uncle Sam loves you. Uncle Sam is going to give you a benefit. So first of all, you're going to want to consult with a tax attorney. But the basic rule is if you don't have any capital gains, you can offset up to $3,000 of your ordinary income by making a sale and taking a loss.
So he should sell at this point and then just take the loss on his taxes.
Just take the loss on his taxes. And then depending on, you know, what his tax situation is, he'll either offset some capital gain long term or short term, or he'll offset some ordinary income.
Chris, who does and should invest in penny stocks?
Nobody. The only people that make money off of penny stocks are the, you know, the boiler rooms. I can't figure out who else makes money off of penny stocks. You've seen the movies, right?
And,
you know, and they're making the calls and they're saying, you know, you got to buy it. You got to buy it. These are the cold call specialists. Of course, now they've moved over to the internet, but they still do the cold calls.
All right, folks. So the lesson here, no more penny stocks.
No.
Chris has said it once, if not twice, if not 100 times. No penny stocks. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks for giving us so much more than a penny stock's worth of advice today.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Up next, the latest installment of Educating RICO, in which our hero suggests a solution to the housing mess, refi.
We might have had a lot fewer foreclosures today, and perhaps a stock market that wasn't acting like a tilt-a-whirl.
And it's your chance to act out and tell us what we're doing right and wrong. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. As we mentioned earlier, the foreclosure numbers just get worse and worse. This week, the Fed issued new guidance for lenders to help homeowners refinance their mortgages. But you can't refi if you barely know what it means. On this installment of our series, Educating RICO, our own Rico Galliano learns how a refi works and why sometimes it doesn't.
Hi, I'm Rico, and I'm jealous of my friends.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome.
That's Linda. She lives in L.A. with her brilliant, tenured professor husband, Robert, along with awesome son, Ricky.
Hi.
And adorable two-year-old Sophie.
Blah.
Linda and Robert's three-bedroom house is also something to envy. Lots of space, backyard swimming pool, and let's not forget what they paid for it 9 years ago.
The asking price was $198. I know.
That's a laugh of disbelief. These days in L.A., $198,000 couldn't buy you a pothole. The house is now worth about $500,000. But wait, as Robert explained to me, after they took out two mortgages to buy the place, things got even better.
A few years later, when the rates had dropped, we realized that we could actually lower our monthly payment by getting a single mortgage at a lower interest rate.
So I looked at the note that you have for your original mortgage, 7.35% 30-year fixed mortgage. What did you refinance at?
About 6.4, something like that. The second time we refinanced, when the rates had dropped even further, that would be our current rate, 5.9.
Actually, we checked the paperwork, and it was even lower, 5.75. This was in 2004, when rates were the lowest in decades. Robert and Linda weren't the only ones to take advantage of it either.
At the time we refinanced, the people who were processing the loans had hired temp work. This is true, to hire, handle all the mortgages, because so many people were refinancing at that time.
All of which leads me to ask, why didn't everybody refinance? If all the folks with adjustable rate mortgages had made like Robert did in 2004, or even in 05 or early 06, we might have had a lot fewer foreclosures today, and perhaps a stock market that wasn't acting like a tilt-a-whirl. Clearly, there's a lot about this refinancing stuff I'm not quite getting, so here to talk about it is Elizabeth Razzi. She's a columnist for The Washington Post and author of The Fearless Homebuyer. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. So let's just get right to it. Why did borrowers not do the obvious thing and refinance when they could have?
Because they couldn't. Many of them found there were very large prepayment penalties in their mortgage if they paid it off early to avoid an increase in interest rates.
A refinancing is considered a prepayment?
You betcha.
Why would anyone get a mortgage with that stipulation in it?
It's not usually a good idea, and many of them didn't realize it was there. It can be an acceptable thing to do if you really are aware of it. That's a sophisticated borrower's kind of decision. A lot of these people were not sophisticated borrowers, and these things certainly were not explained to them the way they should have been.
Oh, lovely. Is that the main reason? Is there another reason?
There sure is another reason. A lot of people found that their homes went down in value. If you took out that loan, bought the house with a zero down payment, and took out a mortgage for the 100% of the loan home's value, and you want to refinance it, but now the house is worth less than it was when you took out that original mortgage, you're stuck. A lender is not going to give you that extra money.
Let me ask you then, right now, does it make any sense for someone to refinance?
Sure. And there are many borrowers who can, and there are many borrowers who have refinanced. They're not the ones that are making the headlines, of course.
Okay. Now, I hear a lot in the news about jumbo loans and non-jumbo loans. Does it really matter which I have in terms of whether or not I should refi?
You're going to find it easier to refinance a non-jumbo loan. That's basically a mortgage for less than $417,000, especially one of the perverse things that's happened with all this turmoil in the bond market and the stock markets is that interest rates on non-jumbos have been going down lately.
Why is that?
Because two big government-sponsored companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are still buying mortgages under that amount. Larger loan amounts are called jumbos. Those are sold off to investors on Wall Street, and Wall Street's been having a bit of a rough time over the last few weeks.
Oh, really?
Yes, exactly. Trying to figure out what these types of loans might be worth. And so it's very difficult to get the money.
And by the way, I should remind our listeners who don't live in major metro areas, you can't buy closet space in L.A. without getting a jumbo loan. But first of all, how long do you think rates will continue to decline on those non-jumbo loans?
If I knew that, I could make a lot of money somewhere other than in journalism. The thing to do is to simply shop. Don't simply rely on a mortgage broker to do it for you. Pick up the phone and check out some interest rates yourself. If you find a better deal, keep an eye on what your transaction costs are going to be. I mean, a refinance really is not free. The costs associated with it would be rolled over into your new mortgage amount.
Is this complicated? I mean, basically, in the last episode of this very series, we talked about mortgage documents, and that sucker is huge and daunting, and I don't blame anyone for really not wanting to go through it again. Is a refinance document as complicated?
They're almost as complicated. You're taking out a whole new mortgage. You don't have the papers that dealt with the transfer of property itself. But you still need to look at the fine print, and you have to look for things like prepayment penalties. Even if this was all told to you before you applied to the mortgage, make sure that's what the documents actually say.
Can I ask, where do you start looking for a refi? The lender you're with, do you have to start with them?
No, you don't have to look with them, but you know, it's a good starting point. A good place to look for interest rates and day-to-day comparisons is bankrate.com.
What did we ever do without the internet?
I don't remember.
But lucky for us, it's here to stay. So if you're thinking about a refi, the first step is a mouse click away. And if you're worried about going through the mortgage process a second time, well, just listen to little Sophie.
Hey, can you say mortgage?
Mortgage.
Can you say refinance?
Refinance.
Suddenly doesn't seem so scary, does it? In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Most of today's retirees don't have to worry about refinancing to avoid losing their homes to foreclosure. Their generation grew up with the idea that you never, ever buy more house than you can afford. But there are other issues facing retirees, like what happens when you're no longer able to do the things you need to do as a homeowner, but you don't want to leave the house. Ren Elhai reports on a new concept called aging in place.
After 47 years in Washington, D.C.'s Capitol Hill neighborhood, 83-year-old Grover Batts is used to life on his block.
You have everything that you need. You have your cleaners, your little teeny grocery stores.
25 years after retiring, though, it's harder for Batts to get around. There are more doctor's appointments to get to, and he relies on his neighbors to help him find repairmen. Some of his friends have moved out to retirement homes, but Batts says it's depressing to visit them. He couldn't imagine living there.
I just have this feeling of being such a kind of a sad, bleak, you know, place to live. And I think that I would, if possible, I want to stay where I am.
A number of Batts' neighbors feel the same way. They formed Capitol Hill Village, one of a growing number of community organizations that help seniors stay in their own homes. One of his neighbors took Batts to an informational meeting. At the meeting, founding member Mike Canning explained things. Members pay an annual fee, and in exchange, they can call a central phone number to get help with whatever they need.
Ranging from home care to taking out the garbage, to doing your grocery shopping, to cleaning your gutter, to making sure you get your taxes done and in on time.
Volunteers will handle much of that. For when members need outside help, the group will maintain a list of vetted professionals. The organization also hopes to offer a full calendar of social gatherings, trips, and group meetings. Membership costs $500 a year. Capitol Hill Village is modeled directly on a five-year-old project in Boston called Beacon Hill Village. Susan McQuinney Morse was one of its founders. She says while at the start they weren't sure if Beacon Hill would work, now it's hard to keep up with all the people who want a village where they live.
We've gotten 3,000 inquiries from all over the world.
At the heart of the Beacon Hill Village model is that seniors have full control of the organization and help each other stay independent.
We're healthier than ever before. We have more money than older people used to have. There are more of us, and there's no reason why we need to suddenly turn our lives over to somebody else to care for, because we're quite capable of doing it ourselves. And I think that's what almost every older person feels. And I think that's what appeals to so many people.
Tom Nelson, the chief operating officer of the AARP, says that sentiment is spreading across the country.
This is a, if you will, a movement that's taking off, and there'll be variations, and people will figure out, well, that's not quite what needs to work in our neighborhood. We need to do something a little bit different.
Back in Washington, Grover Batts is convinced. He signs the Capitol Hill Village membership papers and promises to send a check.
It's like a kind of a dream come true in a way, that you really can stay where you are with a little help. Was it from your friends?
Capitol Hill Village hopes to have its services up and running by this fall. In Washington, I'm Ren Elhai for Marketplace Money.
All right, as you know, we have a weekly mailbag to answer your burning financial questions. Well, every month we also have a letters segment for your comments about the show. So here we go. A couple of weeks ago in our speed round mailbag, Chris and I chewed over a question from a listener asking what to do about a $5,000 debt that he'd forgotten about from 15 years ago. We suggested he hang up on the collection agency, check out the statute of limitations, and document everything in writing. Well, a public radio colleague, Lisa Simeone of Baltimore, Maryland, caught us failing to give the most basic advice of all.
Nowhere was it mentioned that maybe he should pay the debt. What a concept. Responsible borrowing entails responsible payment. It's common sense.
Point taken. We've received many responses to our year-long series profiling three investment clubs. Most of you want to know how to start your own. But Imad Libas of St. Paul, Minnesota, added a cautionary note.
I realize that your series on investment clubs makes for interesting radio, but I think that you're missing an opportunity when you feature, without comment, a slew of behaviors that go against your ordinarily sound financial advice. You should at least mention that the vast majority of clubs would have been better off investing in a low-cost index fund, a conclusion I have no doubt the data would support.
It's true that most investors would do well to put their money in index funds. But the point of investment clubs, at least the ones we've been working with this year, is to learn about the stock market. And index funds aren't going to teach them how to evaluate a company's price-to-earnings ratio or how to read the fine print in an annual report. They're also well aware of the risks involved in stocks, and they're not playing with education or retirement money. That said, it is good to remind everyone that these folks are not experts, and unless you're part of their club, you shouldn't be investing based on what they're doing. And finally, Ethan Munson of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, contacted us after hearing a Straight Story segment about the trend in higher education to charge more tuition for students in certain majors. Chris didn't like that idea at all. But Ethan has a different perspective as a State University engineering professor.
I have great sympathy for his position. But at my school, it's just not practical. Educating an engineer costs 25 to 50% more than educating a typical liberal arts major. Faculty salaries are one cost, but expensive laboratory equipment is another. So we either have to try something to raise more money or decide that we will provide mediocre facilities. Which would you prefer that we choose?
If you'd like to answer Professor Munson's question or just want to give us your opinion about the show, drop us a line. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, we all know that we spend more than any other country on healthcare, and I guess that's why I find this number stunning. Last year, 47 million Americans went without health insurance.
Oh, I know. But you also hear, look, you know, if they get sick, they can show up in the emergency room.
Who said that? I believe it was the president, was it not?
What a deal, huh?
Yeah. But, you know, we also recently got a sign from someone else of just how bad our healthcare system has become. You want to talk about this?
All right. This story stunned me. And it comes from an economist, Lawrence Kotlikoff, who was at a conference. And believe it or not, former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. She's worried about uninsured medical bills. Turns out her son can't afford insurance because his son, O'Connor's grandson, has a pre-existing condition.
Wow.
Meanwhile, on the campaign trail, we keep hearing presidential candidates say stuff like this.
We have the best healthcare system in the world.
Well, here's the straight story. Don't believe it. Instead, ask how to make that statement true.
All right. Well, let's pretend that you're on the campaign trail.
Oh, you're going to put me up against the wall now, aren't you?
Yes. How do we make that statement true?
The way we make that statement true is to start from this place. We need universal health insurance coverage, period. Right now, there's a big inter-party debate going within the Republican Party. Should you be using tax deductions to pay for health care or tax credits? Sounds fairly technical, fairly boring, go to sleep. Well, but here's the difference. With a tax deduction, you don't get universal health care insurance. With a tax credit, a universal tax credit, you do get universal health insurance. Hmm. So that actually is the key place to start. Secondly, we have a balkanized system where employers offer to their workers, or at least some employers do, health insurance, which, by the way, that system has been falling apart. And then the elderly are in Medicare, and then you have the poor, they're in Medicaid, and we have this very balkanized system. And I'm in the camp that says, hey, it's called the healthcare system. Get rid of all these categories, and let's put everybody under one umbrella, and then we can have what is a serious debate. Do you use vouchers to pay for it? Do you use tax credits? That's fine with me. But I say give the doctors choice, keep insurance companies, have universal health care coverage. and vote for me for president.
You got my vote, man. So you have these people who go around saying that we have the best healthcare system in the world, but really isn't what they're saying that we have the best healthcare? It's the insurance system that's broken, not necessarily the care that we're getting.
That's right. And if you have certain medical conditions, we really do have the best healthcare in the world. Yeah. However, when you look at some measures that really matter, life expectancy, we're 78th in the world.
Yikes.
Infant mortality, we're at the bottom of the list among developed nations. And other countries have been spending much less, and they have longer life expectancy than we do. And by the way, we don't have the kind of choice. I mean, I keep reading that we have choice in this system. I don't know what employer can afford to give their employees a whole lot of choice when it comes to health insurance. They really can't anymore. And it's really hurting our international competitiveness. Hmm. And it's also not giving us the benefits. I mean, if we're spending trillions and life expectancy is soaring, fine. But that's not what's happening.
Then let me ask you this, which is the question I ask you pretty much every time on political issues, which is,
okay,
is anything ever actually going to happen on this issue? We hear about it every single presidential election cycle. Healthcare is going to be the big issue, and it never gets fixed.
But, you know, the anecdote about Sandra Day O'Connor, which came from economist Lawrence Kotlikoff, and he makes an important point. There's a lot of fear in the middle class surrounding healthcare. It's no longer somebody else's problem of the poor. If Sandra Day O'Connor and her son are worried about uninsured medical bills, it's everybody. I think that the Washington political system would love nothing better than to avoid the issue. They will not be able to.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, we can always count on you never to avoid the issue.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the right way to start over.
I mean, if you pay off all your debt and then you go home and you start the same bad spending that you've had in the past, you're going to be right back into trouble.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.